This is Kurt Benrud for the Triangle Radio Reading Service, welcoming you to another edition of Did You Know?
And this is Para Tolleson. This program's designed for a print and visually impaired audience.
And this is Bob Martin. And I just found the best restaurant to eat at in Raleigh.
How did you find out it was the best restaurant?
Well, they had a sign in the window. I also found the best dry cleaners and the best drugstore and even the best gasoline.
And this is all because you saw a sign.
You betcha. Then I went into a grocery store. They had a big sign that said lowest prices. And do you know what I found? Not only were their prices the lowest, but they were selling the best products. There was the best toothpaste, the best mouthwash, the best frozen pizza. Oh, just the best everything.
Okay, Bob?
I don't know why people make shopping be so hard. It's easy. Just walk in and look for the right sign.
All right, Bob, slow down. You are talking about advertising.
But they said it was the best.
Understand, Bob. Advertising language is not the same as regular language.
How can they say it's best if it's not true?
Well, to you, best means one thing. To advertisers, it means something else. And it's all legal. Businesses use a concept that is called parity items. Everything in a group, pick anyone you want, is basically the same. So nothing is better than anything else. Therefore, they are all the best.
And when you go to a restaurant and the ad says, voted best in the city, it was voted best in the city by somebody. You sit at the table, and there are little forms by the salt and pepper shakers. The form asks you something like, was this your best eating experience tonight? You put down, yes, you just voted. It's the best. No general election, one person votes. That's all it takes. They're all the best.
My brother and I used to go to Reno once in a while, and every casino claimed that they had the best buffet and the loosest slots and the best seafood bar and the best, well, whatever. Now I know how they could do it. Everything can be the best.
Right, but it can't be better. You see, better implies a comparison. For someone to claim their product is better, there have to be standards set and tests run and provable results obtained and evaluated. Best can just be said, but better has to be proven.
Then there's the whole realm of better than ever or new and improved. A bigger box or a box of a different color makes it new and improved. And beware of pitch lines like, they say, who's they, and tests prove. Tests may prove that people like green boxes better than brown ones, but that doesn't tell you anything about the quality of the product.
There has been a lovely name given to these kind of expressions. They're called weasel words.
Why call them that?
When a weasel raids the chicken house, he doesn't steal the egg. He sucks the insides out, and then it looks like everything is all right. So the weasel words make you think one thing is true about the product, but is it really true? Well, what do you think of that, Bob?
Well, I think that the Triangle Radio Reading Service is the best in the area.
And why do you think that?
Because we didn't have to put up a sign. And better than that, everyone knows, and tests have shown, that they say we are new and improved.
Why do they say that?
Well, because you and I and Parra are there.
Proves it to me.
You can't argue with reasoning like that.
And that's a true story.
While we let that logic settle in, did you know the difference between caffeine-free and decaffeinated? Caffeine is a naturally occurring substance in coffee, tea, and cola drinks. When the caffeine is removed, that's decaffeinated. Caffeine-free is a drink that has not yet had caffeine added to it.
Did you know that caffeine is added to most cola drinks in order to give it a little zip? It also is slightly addictive, which makes you keep going back for more.
Did you know what happens to the caffeine that they remove from coffee during decaffeination? Most of it is sold to soda companies to add to the cola drinks.
Did you know how much caffeine is in our various foods? Well, here's an approximate. Okay, brewed coffee, 180 milligrams. A drink like Coca-Cola, 46 milligrams per 12 ounces. One like Pepsi Cola, 36.4 milligrams per 12 ounces. And surprise, one like Mountain Dew, 54 milligrams. It's also added to aspirin to enhance its painkilling qualities. So there are 64 milligrams of caffeine in a tablet of Excedrin.
A cup of coffee in the morning helps some people to get up and get going, but it's recommended that you don't exceed 5 cups a day. After that, you might feel palpitations, nervousness, and trembling.
Did you know that last night I read about a poor fellow who drank himself to death?
Right. Alcohol can do that to you.
Oh, no, this wasn't alcohol. It was coffee.
What? I knew about the jitters from too much coffee, but dying?
Bob's right. Caffeine is an addictive drug, and too much of it over a short period can be lethal.
Like how much?
It depends on how much you weigh and how strong the coffee. But a lethal dose for an adult is about 10 grams. An adult could reach that amount by drinking between 50 and 100 cups in rapid succession.
The government has a test to show toxicity of all sorts of products, and the results are given as a comparison of body weight and dosage.
So here are a few examples you might find interesting. And remember, the higher the number, the safer it is, because it takes more to do you harm. Very low numbers are lethal.
Now, before you start, I used to work for a parks department and did all the spraying for the city. The product I used most was the most commonly used weed killer. I don't think anybody is going to drink weed killer on purpose, so this toxicity number is just for comparison. For the weed killer, it was over 5,000. Now, some other samples. And remember, the higher the number, the safer the product.
Okay, for sugar, the number is 29,700. For alcohol, it's 7,060. For salt, it's 3,000. For THC, it's 1,270 for men and 730 for women.
What's THC?
The active ingredient in marijuana. Not a recommendation, just facts.
Hey, aspirin, 200. And now, caffeine, 192. Nicotine, 50. Botox, 0.00001.
Smile.
Incidentally, if you're interested in this kind of information, they're provided on what is called a Material Safety Data Sheet, or MSDS. They're available on the Internet, or stores can request one from the manufacturer if you ask.
There is one substance you forgot to mention, and it might affect that 50 to 100 cups of coffee.
What's that?
Water.
Water?
Believe it or not, you can die from drinking too much water. We're supposed to consume about a gallon a day, but our problems can occur during extreme athletic participation or fraternity hazing or other situations when water is consumed in large amounts without giving the body time to regenerate electrolytes.
Do you have any examples of that?
Why, yes, I do. In 1999, an Air Force recruit died of sunstroke complicated by extreme water intoxication.
In 2002... a 4-year-old girl in Utah died after being forced to drink a gallon of water as a part of a discipline. The parents were convicted of child abuse, homicide.
Also in 2002, a 3-year-old girl in Florida died when her babysitter forced her to drink 3 quarts of water in a 4-hour period.
In 2005, a California college student died from heart failure caused by water intoxication during a fraternity hazing.
In 2007... a 28-year-old California woman died while trying to win a contest. It involved drinking the most water without urinating.
Are you ready for the name of the contest? Hold Your Wee for Wee. She won $16.5 million in a wrongful death suit.
And in 2008, a British woman died after drinking 4 liters of water in under 2 hours as part of her Lighter Life diet plan.
I'm convinced. I'll take the pledge.
What pledge?
Well, remember the motto from the old Women's Temperance Union?
Sure, lips that taste wine will never touch mine.
Well, here's one to add to it. If he offers you H2O, don't plan to stay. Get up and go.
Oh, dear.
Okay, Para. How about another poser for Bob? I think he needs it.
I just happen to have one. Okay. A man lives on the 22nd floor of a high-rise apartment. Every morning after breakfast, he goes to work.
What did he have for breakfast?
I don't know. Sometimes cereal, sometimes bacon and eggs. It doesn't matter.
How much coffee?
Probably.
1 or 2 cups?
2, I guess. It doesn't matter.
Well, it might. Remember about what caffeine can do to you.
Just listen to the story, Bob. Go on, Para.
Okay, right. Just listen to the story. After he finishes his breakfast of cereal or bacon and eggs and 2 cups of coffee, he washes all his dishes and put them back in the cupboard, then wipes the crumbs off the table and then...
Para, I don't think all of that matters. Go on with the story.
Jeez, what's important is that he lives on the 22nd floor. When he gets on the elevator, he goes to the ground floor and then goes to work.
Does he have coffee break at work?
Of course.
One or two a day. And then at lunch?
Bob, if you want him to, that's fine with me.
I just want to make sure I understand the problem.
Good for you. The story, the man lives on the 22nd floor, gets on the elevator in the morning, and rides all the way down. But when he goes home, he only rides the elevator up to the 12th floor and then walks the rest of the way.
Does the building have a 13th floor? Some don't, you know. Superstition.
Bob, it doesn't matter.
Maybe going down it doesn't matter. He's riding the elevator. But it makes a big difference if you have to walk up. That means another flight of stairs. And if you're carrying groceries or something heavy like that...
Oh, okay. It does have a 13th floor. The question is, why does he walk when he could ride?
Well, that's simple. He had too much coffee during the day. You told us that after 5 cups you could start getting the jitters and nerves and blurred vision and itchy skin and...
Okay, get to the point, Bob.
Well, with all the problems of drinking too much coffee, he can't see the keypad properly and pushes the 12 instead of the 22. You gotta quit drinking all that coffee. That reminds me of something else. It happened back during the Revolutionary War. Did you know that John Hancock was once chasing a notorious British spy that he knew was in cahoots with Benedict Arnold? He had staked out this little Italian restaurant in North Boston, down from the Haymarket, and just across from the Charles River Bridge. He knew the spy frequented this restaurant. Besides, oh, it had great spaghetti and meatballs. He waited for a while and then thought that, well, he'd better order dinner, you know, so he wouldn't look suspicious. He ordered the spaghetti and meatballs. Suddenly, into the restaurant walked this woman in red. They always wear red. Hancock knew she was the girlfriend of the spy. She took a look around and then started to leave. Hancock had to follow her, even though he had ordered the spaghetti and meatballs and he really was hungry. But democracy was at stake. He had to capture that spy. He figured he could come back and finish his dinner later. So he hollered out to the waiter. Hey, waiter, hold a meatball. I have to chase the chick and catch a Tory.
I was reminded of that story when, a few years ago, my wife and I took a trip back to Boston.
We had been visiting the Bunker Hill site and had just walked back over the Charles River Bridge. As we crossed the bridge, there was a big mural on the side of an Italian restaurant. So we went in and had dinner.
You had spaghetti and meatballs.
No. What made you think of that?
I had pizza.
Because the bridge is down the Charles River from the Mystic River, and we had just seen the movie, Mystic Pizza. It was one of the first movies that Julia Roberts made. And in the movie, she worked in a pizza parlor.
So, I had pizza.
Anyway, the restaurant was up on the second story with a great view back over the Charles River. We started talking about the baseball game we had seen at Fenway Park. Oh, was that exciting. Pedro Martinez was pitching, and Johnny Damon made this great catch right in front of us.
There I was, up on the second story, having pizza and thinking about Johnny Damon's great catch. And that reminded me of the story of John Hancock. Oh, I guess I forgot to tell you. My wife had chicken cacciatore.
Para, don't bang your head. Believe it or not, you'll adjust. How about bell time? Did you know that steam rising off of a cup of coffee has the same amount of antioxidants as 3 oranges?
Did you know that the Mr. Potato Head was the first toy advertised on television?
Did you know that, unlike other fruits, cranberries don't show their ripeness by color? You bounce them. Good cranberries bounce. Bad ones don't.
Did you know that Dr. Seuss wrote Green Eggs and Ham after his editor challenged him that he couldn't write a book using 50 words or less? Seuss claims that the editor never paid up.
Did you know there's an excretion for the civet cat that has a foul odor, but when properly mixed in a perfume, it becomes an aphrodisiac? This created the allure of the first Chanel No. 5.
Did you know that the world's oldest recipe was found in 1850 outside of Baghdad? It was found on a 3,800-year-old Sumerian clay tablet and was a recipe for making beer. The 2 tablets found with the recipe are believed to be drinking songs.
Did you know there are about 144,000 mosquitoes for each person on Earth?
Did you know that mosquito repellent does not actually repel mosquitoes? It blocks their sensors so they don't know you're there.
Did you know that in 2003, the personal fortune of J.K. Rowling, the author of the Harry Potter series, became greater than that of the Queen of England?
Did you know that members of the U.S. Congress are the highest paid legislators in the world?
Did you know that once Winston Churchill had a heart attack in the White House while trying to open a bedroom window?
And did you know every 20 minutes the population of the planet increases by 3,500? During the same time period, one or more plant or animal species becomes extinct, approximately 27,000 per year.
Thinking back to Bob's pledge about water made me think about the original pledge during the temperance movement. Lips that taste wine shall never touch mine. That indeed referred to a kiss as a display of love and affection. Did you know that the kiss, originally and in some parts of the world, is not seen in the romantic sense?
In our history, we see it first as a pledge or guarantee, or a sign of obedience or subservience. When you meet a high religious leader, what did you do?
Kiss his ring.
Right, and the king?
His ring, or sometimes his feet.
In some cases where you kissed the king determined what your status was, the peasants were relegated to the feet.
What about the expression, sealed with a kiss? That's a love letter, isn't it?
Well, let's look at where the expression came from. In days when a large part of the population was illiterate, how did they sign a document?
Well, they put their mark on it, usually an X.
And to assure their pledge, they then kissed the mark.
So even letters of emotion sent by swains to their sweethearts, the kiss was not romantic so much as a guarantee of the truth of their emotions.
When the kiss spread to encompass a greeting, it still wasn't seen as specifically romantic, but rather a pledge of friendship. In the 16th century, Erasmus noted that when he traveled to England, he observed that a visitor to a home would kiss the host, the hostess, the children, and even the dog and the cat.
Hardly romantic.
I don't think so. In other places, a kiss from the Tsar was seen as a height of official recognition.
And in Italy, a public kiss was seen almost as an absolute that the couple was to marry. Again, not romantic, but a pledge. Some disreputable young men would try to force a girl into a kiss, thus causing a marriage. That's one of the reasons young girls appeared on the streets, and even in church, wearing long veils.
In all these cases, the kiss deals with touch, but there are many cultures, even today, where the romantic is expressed through smell. When the faces are brought together, the persons do not touch, but come close and then inhale the aroma of the other person.
We make jokes about Eskimos rubbing noses, but that's not really what it's happening. It's the aroma.
Most cultures of Asiatic background and Laplanders and Eskimos and North and South American Aborigines practice this form of expression.
Here's a funny story for you. Before the war in Indochina, natives used to scare unruly children by threatening to give them the white man's kiss.
Whatever the background, the romantic kiss is certainly a part of current Western culture, leading to and integral to marriage.
And speaking of marriage, we still maintain a lot of wedding customs without them meaning anything. For instance, the something old, something new, something borrowed, something blue.
It's part of a poem with the last line and a silver sixpence in her shoe. And not surprisingly, the whole poem is of English origin.
The sense of it is something old, her family heritage, something new, hope for the future, something borrowed, friends to rely on if problems arise. Something blue, a traditional color of faithfulness and loyalty. Add now the sixpence, financial security.
The bride wears white. Why? Surprise, because the queen did. The tradition of wearing white began in 1840 when Queen Victoria wore it at her wedding to Albert.
The connection with purity didn't occur until 1849. The association was made in an American publication, Godey's Lady's Book. By the way, the editor of the Philadelphia-based magazine was Sarah Josepha Hale, the author of Mary Had a Little Lamb.
The veil, possibly to protect against evil spirits or possibly from an even earlier time when the marriage had been arranged and the bride and the groom might not know what each other actually looked like.
The Chinese believed that it was bad luck for the bride's feet to touch the floor, so they spread a red carpet for her to walk on. Now we have the runner that she walks on.
The early French believed in wine at the reception, but their wine was not always sweet to the taste, so they added bits of toasted bread to absorb the bad flavors. The first person to drink the wine and swallow the bread gave a speech, thus the bride's toast.
To prevent evil spirits from tripping her when she entered her new home, the groom carried her over the threshold. And then they hid away for a month and drank a mead with honey. Thus, the honeymoon.
There was another reason for hiding away. During the times when the bride was actually kidnapped, you had a best man who stood with his hand on his sword to prevent anyone from interrupting the ceremony. And then they hid away until her family quit looking for her.
And remember the chivalry? All the friends gathered around to make noise and disturbances, and some reported that when no chivalry took place, the couple felt that their friends didn't really like them.
Hey, that helped. Now I know why the guy got off on the 12th floor.
And why is that?
Well, it's obvious. He has a girlfriend down there, and he's trying to impress her. Every night he brings her presents. Old, new, borrowed, blue. He started out with one, and now he's up to 120. And she's probably already planning a chivalry because there was an awful lot of yelling going on the night they brought the maids a milking.
Para, stop pulling your hair. All right. Okay, now I've got a story for you.
Wait until he brings the Lord's a-leaping.
Please.
All right. A mushroom walked into a bar one night and said, "Drinks for the house." Well, everybody ran up to the bar, and the bartender started pouring just as fast as he could. When things slowed up a little bit, the bartender leaned over to the guy and says, "Thanks a lot. The fellows here really appreciate it, but what's the occasion?" "Oh, nothing special." The bartender then asked, "Well, then why are you doing it?" The mushroom replied, "Oh, I'm just a fun guy."
Okay, Kurt, that was supposed to help.
Didn't it?
Not as much as this one will. You know, I have an Aunt Mildred.
Oh, hey, wait a minute. I thought you told us that she'd been eaten by the state lion.
Well, she heals quickly. Anyway, she was very close friends with Roy Rogers and Dale Evans. Seems that Roy went one day and bought himself a brand new pair of expensive leather boots. He came home, and for 3 straight days, he oiled and flexed them and put them out on the front porch to dry. The next morning, he went out to get them, and only to find that during the night, a wild cat had come up on the porch, grabbed the new boots, and literally chewed them to bits. Roy stood there for a few minutes, just looking at the shredded pieces and leather lying there. Then, without saying a word, he walked inside, picked up his hat and his rifle, and headed out to the barn. He saddled Trigger and headed out. He was gone for 5 days. When he finally returned, he rode up to the front porch with a dead wildcat tied to the back of his horse. Dale walked out next to him and patted him on the arm and then asked, "Pardon me, Roy, is that the cat that chewed your new shoes?"
"I think it's bell time." Did you know that actor Humphrey Bogart was once a professional chess player?
Did you know that toilet paper was invented by the Chinese? In 1391, the Bureau of Imperial Supplies began supplying 720,000 sheets of paper a year for the exclusive use by the emperor. The sheets were 2 feet by 3 feet.
Did you know that in 1973, there was a toilet paper shortage in this country? Johnny Carson on The Tonight Show made a joke about it, and the people took it seriously. And soon, there was a stampede on toilet paper.
Did you know the Chinese also came up with chess, fireworks, fishing poles, and fish hooks, hot air balloons, kites, and parachutes?
Did you know that in 2004, the IKEA Glossy Catalog became the most distributed publication with 145 million copies? The Bible was second at 25 million, but the Bible is still the most shoplifted book in the world.
Did you know that the lifespan of the average NHL hockey puck is 7 minutes? Those don't go into the stands, heat up due to friction, and then bounce from the ice. The ideal temperature is minus 10 degrees Fahrenheit.
Did you know that in 1659, the Massachusetts General Court ordered a 5-shilling fine for anyone celebrating Christmas? And the ban wasn't revoked until 1681.
Did you know that Disney World in Orlando, Florida covers 30,500 acres? That's twice the size of Manhattan.
Did you know that the original Biltmore Estate was 125,000 acres?
Did you know that the elephant goes through 6 sets of teeth during its lifetime? When the 6th set falls out, the animal dies of starvation.
Did you know that technically monkeys don't have feet because they possess opposable thumbs that are classified as having 4 hands?
Did you know that under the Federal Drug and Cosmetic Act, Leeches and maggots are classified as medical devices.
This is not a bell ringer, but here's an interesting fact. Do you know how many states there are in the United States?
Well, wait a minute. This has got to be a trick question. Do you mean how many once upon a time, or how many states right now?
Right now.
Well, then it's 50.
No. A while back, I was in Boston, and there was a historical sign. It didn't say the state of Massachusetts. It said the Commonwealth of Massachusetts.
Good for you. Good for you. You see, there are 46 states and 4 commonwealths.
What's the difference?
Not a thing. It's just an historical curiosity of what the people wanted to call themselves.
Right. After Massachusetts, I went to Philadelphia. Here also was a sign that said Commonwealth of Pennsylvania.
Likewise, Virginia and Kentucky.
No difference. It's just in the name. Like with the counties. 48 states call their subdivisions counties, and Louisiana calls them parishes.
I knew that. And Alaska calls them boroughs and census areas.
Did you know that the U.S. has 2 territories that are called commonwealths? Puerto Rico and Northern Marianas.
That piece about the parishes in Louisiana gave me an idea about the man on the 12th floor. In the French Quarter of Disneyland, there is an exhibit called The Haunted Mansion. When you get into the anteroom, they close the doors and start the ride. You don't know it at first, but you're on an elevator. As you go down, everything stretches, so what you thought was there isn't there at all. That's what would be happening between the 12th and the 22nd floors. Everything is not what it seems. He knows he will get down because there has to be a bottom, but he's not sure about getting back up again, so he walks. After all, he's prepaid his rent, and if the elevator lets him off on a strange floor, his key might not work.
Do you know that in spite of his name being on elevators, Otis did not invent the elevator. Way back in the Middle Ages, they had dumbwaiters, which are a kind of elevator. Otis invented the braking system that allowed elevators to be used safely for people.
What has that got to do with my solution?
Well, maybe Otis hid something on top of the elevator car.
That's it! That's it! The added weight makes it impossible for the elevator to go any higher than the 12th floor.
Then how did the elevator get to the 22nd floor to pick up the man in the morning?
Oh, that's simple. The man wasn't on it then. Didn't weigh as much, but I bet they really went down fast.
Looking at some past occurrences in history this week, did you know that in 1937, the official day for the inauguration of our next president was firmly established on January 20th? Some pretty impressive things were said on Inauguration Day. John Kennedy said, "Ask not what your country can do for you, ask rather what you can do for your country."
And Franklin Roosevelt saw one-third of the country ill-housed, ill-clothed, and ill-fed.
Thomas Jefferson said, "Let us unite with one heart and one mind. Let us restore to social intercourse the harmony and affection without which liberty and even life itself are but dreary things. We have gained little if we countenance a political intolerance as despotic, as wicked, and capable of as bitter and bloody persecution. We are called by different names, brethren, but we are of the same principle. We are all Republicans. We are all Federalists."
Harry Truman said, "The supreme need for our time is for men to learn to live together in peace and harmony."
Dwight Eisenhower said, "Whatever America hopes to bring to pass in the world must first come to pass in the heart of America."
Lincoln was viewing a renewed American spirit when he said, "With malice toward none, with charity for all. Let us strive on to finish the work we are in, to do all which may achieve and cherish a just and lasting peace among ourselves and with all nations."
How do you think we've listened?
Not very well, I fear.
The Kingston Trio performed a song entitled "The Merry Minuet," recorded in 1959, which, for me, pretty well sums up the evaluation. Part of it said, "The whole world is festering with unhappy souls. The French hate the Germans hate the Poles. Italians hate the Yugoslavs, South Africans hate the Dutch, and I don't like anybody very much."
And that was over 50 years ago.
Before we leave the events of January 20th, we mentioned the inauguration speech of John Kennedy. As a part of the ceremonies, Robert Frost was supposed to present a poem. It was entitled "Dedication." Did you know that as he rose to speak the poem, there was such a glare that he could not see the page? So instead he recited, by memory, the gift outright.
The land was ours before we were the land's. She was our land more than 100 years before we were her people. She was ours in Massachusetts, in Virginia, but we were England's, still colonials, possessing what we still were unpossessed by, possessed by what we now no more possessed. Something we were withholding made us weak until we found it ourselves. We were withholding from our land of living, and forthwith found salvation in surrender. Such as we were, we gave ourselves outright. The deed of gift was many deeds of war, to the land vaguely realizing westward, but still unstoried, artless, unenhanced, such as she was, such as she would become.
Following is a poem that was meant to be presented on that day.
Summoning artists to participate in the august occasions of the state seems something artists ought to celebrate. Today is for my cause a day of days, and in his be poetry's old-fashioned praise. Who was the first to think of such a thing, this verse, that an acknowledgment I bring? It goes back to the beginning of the end of what had been for centuries the trend. A turning point in modern history, colonial, had been the thing to be, as long as a great issue was to see. What country be the one to dominate, by character, by tongue, by native trait? The new world Christopher Columbus found, the French, the Spanish, and the Dutch were drowned and counted out. Heroic deeds were done. Elizabeth I and England won. Now came on a new order of the ages, that in the Latin of our founding sages is not written on the dollar bill we carry in our purse and pocket still. God nodded his approval of as good, so much those heralds knew and understood. I mean the great four, Washington, John Adams, Jefferson, and Madison. So much they saw as consecrated seers. They must have seen ahead what not appears. They would bring empires down upon our ears. And by the example of our declaration, made everybody want to be a nation. And this is no aristocratic joke, the expense of negligible folk. We see how seriously the races swarm in their attempts at sovereignty and form. They are our wards, we think, to some extent, for the time being and with their consent, to teach them how democracy is meant. New order of the ages, did they say? If it looks none too orderly today, 'tis a confusion. It was ours to start, so in it have to take courageous part. No one of honest feeling would approve a ruler who pretended not to love the turbulence he had the better of. Everyone knows the glory of the twain who gave America the aeroplane to ride the whirlwind and the hurricane. Some poor fool has been saying in his heart, glory is out of date in life and art. Our venture in revolution and outlawry has justified itself in freedom's story. Right down to now, when glory upon glory come fresh from an election like the last, the greatest vote a people ever cast. So close, yet sure to be abided by, it is no miracle our mood is high. Courage is in the air, embracing whiffs, better than all the stalemates, ands, and ifs. There was the book of profile tales declaring for the emboldened politicians daring to break with the followers when in the wrong a healthy independence of the throng, a democratic form of right divine to rule first answerable to high design. There is a call to life, a little sterner and braver for the earner, learner, yearner, less criticism of the field and court and more preoccupation with the sport. It makes the prophet in us all presage the glory of a next Augustan age, of a power leading from its strength and pride, of young ambition cagered to be tried, firm in our free beliefs without dismay in any game the nations want to play, a golden age of poetry and power, of which this noonday's the beginning hour.
On January 21st, 1976, the supersonic transport, the Concorde, was put into service. The aircraft was a joint French-British venture, first flown in 1969, and finally put into commercial service in 1976. The first routes scheduled were from London and Paris to New York and Washington.
If you wanted a fast trip, this is the way to go. The fastest transatlantic crossing occurred on February 7, 1996, when one of the ships went from London to New York in 2 hours, 52 minutes, and 59 seconds. And to celebrate Columbus coming to the New World, one ship starting in Portugal on October 12, 1992, and flew around the world in 32 hours, 49 minutes, and 3 seconds.
Now that's traveling fast, but it was also traveling expensive. In U.S. gallons, a Boeing 747 gets 91 miles to the gallon. The Concorde got 14. And since the Concorde held a maximum of 120 passengers, the average fuel consumption went from 2.6 liters per passenger per kilometer to 16.6. That meant that in 2000, while you could fly from London to New York in about 3 hours, the ticket would cost $8,148.
The aircraft was called Concorde as a symbol of unity and cooperation. But from the popular point of view, cooperation is not what was achieved. There was a fight over the letter E at the end of the name. It wasn't British. When it was put back, the official release said it stood for excellence. England, Europe, and Entente Cordiale, which referred to the pact between England and France that dated back to 1904.
Then Scotland complained. Part of the aircraft had been made in Scotland. Why weren't they included? It was explained that E also stood for Ecosia, the French word for Scotland. That resolved everything except, was it the Concorde or a Concorde?
I guess they hadn't listened to the inauguration speeches either. Anyway, only 20 Concordes were ever made and only 16 put into commercial service. The final flight took place November 26, 2003.
Did you know that on January 20th, 1896, Nathaniel Birnbaum was born? Better known as George Burns, he lived to be 100 years old. In his later years, he was always dating much younger women, and when asked why, he said, "Because all the women my age are dead." He was also asked what concessions he had to make in old age. He replied, "My smoke rings aren't as big and round as they used to be, and in my martinis I've cut down from 2 to 1 olive."
Did you know that on January 21st, 1908, the city of New York passed an ordinance that forbade women to smoke in public? On the very next day, Katie McCaughey was arrested for violating that ordinance. They were going to show those women. However, 2 weeks later, Mayor George Britton McClellan vetoed the ordinance. Apparently, the ladies didn't pay enough attention to start smoking, and it took until 1968 for Virginia Slims to come out with the sales slogan, "You come a long way, baby."
Did you know that on January 24th, 1935, canned beer went on sale for the first time in the United States?
That sounds like an introduction to a beer story.
Sounds good to me. Beer is the most popular alcoholic drink, but it is also the third most popular drink of all kinds. Did you know what the only two beverages are that are more popular than beer?
Well, one has got to be water.
Right. And the other?
Well, I guess milk. No, wait a minute. I take that back. Coffee. Coffee drinkers are universal, and most of them can't get started in the morning without a cup. Maybe even going to work, you pass all kinds of quick stop or drive-through coffee stops. I guess coffee.
I'll give you both your answers, and you'd still be wrong. Tea is second to water, and then beer. Written evidence suggests the existence of beer as far back as 9,000 BCE in Egypt and Mesopotamia, and as far back as 7,000 BCE in China. And there is chemical evidence of its use back to 3,500 BCE in ancient Persia, and laws regulating its making go back to the middle of the second millennium BCE in the Code of Hammurabi.
The basic ingredients of beer are fairly simple. First, you need a starch source, such as malted barley, then add a brewer's yeast for fermentation, a flavoring such as hops and water. And what is malted barley? It's a process. You soak barley in water until it starts to germinate, and then dry in a kiln. This process allows the fermentation to occur.
The basic types of beer are ales and lagers. Now, this isn't Chemistry 1A, so simply, the difference is temperature. Ales are warm fermented and lagers are cold fermented. With these families, there are lots of subgroupings like lambic, which uses wild yeast instead of cultivated, and stout, which are darker using roasted malts. The biggest difference seems to be the water. Every area has its own water, and the water affects the taste.
Since taste is such an individual thing, people tend to favor their beer. That snobbery carries over to critics. In the book, The Good Beer, by Thomas Harper and Garrett Oliver, the authors make this comment about Pilsners, which is in the lager family. They say that true Pilsners were all malt beers that didn't use cheaper products, such as corn, rice, and wheat.
The authors say that didn't apply to American mass-produced Pilsners, which together with mass marketing have allowed large American beer companies to produce a watery beer out of a half-malt mixture with almost no hops. Some use only a hop extract. Then it is filtered to within an inch of its already palate life. This results in a product that is virtually tasteless.
Does that mean that they like it? Well, anyway, beer. I'll drink to that.
And in celebration, we return briefly to our Poet's Corner for a poem about beer. Stopping by a Cooler on a Summer Night, by Joe Alvey.
Whose beers these are, I'm sure I know. He will not see me steal one, though. In the garage, talking his cue, seeking his fourth game in a row. My son must think it strange, it's true, to reach into a cooler blue. He knows that mine is candy red, so why does Dad ignore the hue? I think it best if less is said, so to the house my boy is led, back to his mom and sister dear, to sing and play, and to be fed. The night is young, the sky is clear, and I know where there's lots of beer. And lots of beer that's oh so near, and oh, lots of beer so very near.
Also, speaking of beer, that brings to mind munchies. Did you know the most popular snack food? In 1997-1998, Americans consumed 184 million pounds of peanuts, and more recently they gobbled up 16 million quarts of popcorn, or maybe potato chips. In 2005, potato chips accounted for 35.5% of total sales of snack foods in the United States. So which is it?
Well, I'm sure that is an individual's choice. But I have some test results from another snack product. It may not be the biggest munchies seller, but it might be interesting to learn what we eat.
Oh boy, oh boy, oh boy! I hope you're talking about my favorite, Twinkies.
Oh, no, that's the one. This poor little thing has been much maligned. So, Spy magazine ran some tests, and the results were published in 1989. Exposure. A Twinkie was left on a windowsill for 4 days, during which time 1.5 inches of rain fell. Flies were observed, but no bird, not even a pigeon, would eat it. Although dehydrated after 4 days, the center was still considered creamy.
Radiation. A Twinkie was placed in a conventional microwave for 4 minutes. After 20 seconds, there was an aroma of artificial butter. After 1 minute, the odor changed to burning rubber. After 2 minutes, 10 seconds, the test was aborted when thick smoke started coming out the top of the oven.
Extreme force. The Twinkie was dropped from a height of about 120 feet. The expected splatter did not occur. It hit the ground and bounced onto its back and remained structurally intact.
Cold. A Twinkie was placed in a conventional freezer for 24 hours. It did not freeze, although it did absorb many freezer odors.
Heat. A Twinkie was exposed to a gas flame for 2 minutes. It did not catch fire, but it did produce the same odor of burned rubber from the radiation experiment.
An immersion. A Twinkie was placed in a pot of water. It floated for a moment, then listed and sank. After 2 hours, it had bloated considerably, and after 72 hours, was about 200 times its normal size. Attempts to remove it from the water when the slightest pressure caused it to disintegrate.
Conclusion? Bon appetit.
While we're snacking, we may or may not take a look at the labels on the outside of packages, but in the days of product labeling, the little label may tell you not only what's in the product, but also everything you need to know about safety. Here are some labels you might have missed.
On a hairdryer, do not use while sleeping.
On a bag of Fritos, you may be a winner. No purchase necessary. Details inside.
On a bar of Dial soap, use like regular soap.
On some frozen dinners? Serving suggestion, defrost.
on packaging for an iron. Do not iron clothes on body.
On a child's cough medicine. Do not drive a car or operate machinery.
Printed on the bottom of a dessert from Tesco's. Do not turn upside down.
On a sleep aid, warning, may cause drowsiness.
On a Korean kitchen knife, warning, keep out of children.
On a string of Christmas lights, for indoor or outdoor use only.
On a package of bread pudding, product will be hot after heating.
On a package of shin guards for use by bicyclists. Shin pads cannot protect any part of the body they do not cover.
On an aim and flame fireplace lighter. Do not use near fire, flame, or sparks.
On a coffee cup, caution, hot beverages are hot.
On a toilet bowl cleaning brush, do not use orally.
On a birthday card for a one-year-old, not suitable for children age 36 months or less.
On a laser pointer, do not look into laser with remaining eye.
On a can of air freshener, for use by trained personnel only.
On bottles of Sol Palmetto, which is designed to promote prostate health. Do not take while nursing or pregnant.
On a bottle of sleeping pills obtained from a VA hospital, may cause drowsiness.
I remember an animal park that got sued for not posting warning labels. Someone took off their clothes and jumped into a tank that had a sign, killer whale. The parents said that there was no warning that this might be dangerous.
Okay, I have to comment on that one. Some things you just don't think about, so someone has to call your attention to it, but it seems that the term killer whale ought to be sufficient.
I remember several years ago while visiting a Caribbean island. Now down there, you get downpours. We were about to cross the street when I looked down and saw the gutter. It was about 9 inches wide and about 6 feet deep. Like I said, down there, you get downpours. Also, there was no grating over the top of it. You step there, and down you go. There was a policeman close, and I asked him if there shouldn't be a grating. His answer represents a different way of thinking. He said, "You can see it, can't you? Then don't step in it."
Yeah, they expect you to think, but we don't. And not only that, we reward you for not thinking.
Though we may have all these product labels, remember the weasel words at the beginning of the show? So did you know what some of these labels really mean? It's holiday time, and you want a nice turkey and prefer one not frozen. The label says, never frozen. You assume, wrong. Up until 1998, a turkey that was stored at a temperature above 0 degrees Fahrenheit could be called fresh. Then the FDA changed its rule. Now, to be called fresh, it has to be stored at a temperature above 26 degrees Fahrenheit, which is the freezing point for turkeys. However, if it is stored above 0 degrees Fahrenheit, it doesn't have to be called frozen and can legally say, never frozen.
You buy a weed killer, and the label says ingredients. They're all there, right? Well, almost. According to one study, around 600 toxic chemicals don't have to be included on the label because they're considered inert, not the active killing substances. The companies claim they have to protect their trade secrets.
The CD says, Cape Cod, the enchanting sounds of the surf. You assume... Well, according to the Wall Street Journal, it was recorded in Naples, Florida. The producer said they'd be a fool to go around recording individual sites. Surf was surf.
Recycled paper. You assume that a product was used by a consumer and then sent back and reprocessed to make something else out of it. The only way you can be sure of that is if the product says post-consumer. Otherwise, the government allows a manufacturer to gather up the cuttings off of the floor and dump them back into the paper pulp. The company would do it anyway because it's cost-effective, but now they can say it's recycled. No savings in resources, but it sounds good, and it's legal.
The label says chicken nuggets. What you're getting is, well, we'll get back to you on that one. According to the National Consumer League, things like chicken nuggets, chicken frankfurters, turkey salami, turkey bologna are mechanically deboned, so you're getting whatever goes through the process, bits of bone, skin, glands, marrow, kidneys, whatever. Labeling requirements give companies the leeway of giving just a vague description of what is really in the product.
You know, thanks to the label, I've got that guy on the elevator figured out.
All right, let's hear it.
Okay. Remember the bar where the mushroom went in and bought the drinks? Well, there's a picture on the wall.
It's not really a picture. It's just an empty frame.
But it was a label, and it had a title. What was the title of the picture?
I never paid attention.
Well, you should have. It's called Cow Eating Grass.
Para said the picture was blank. Where's the grass?
The cow ate it all.
So where's the cow?
Well, if the grass has been eaten, why would the cow stay around? She went looking for new grass.
What does that have to do with the man getting off of the elevator on the 12th floor?
Well, I'm getting to that. Every night after work, the guy goes by that bar. He has to clear all the caffeine out of his head, right? But he only has water because he has all those stairs to climb. He sees the picture, and because fields of grass always have mushrooms, there has to be a clue there, right? Then he sees it. There are 14 letters in the title, Cow Eating Grass. Deducting the two spaces, that leaves 12. So he knows he has to look between the 12th and the 14th floors. And you said it didn't matter about the 13th floor.
How did he know to look in his apartment building?
Well, because a few days before that, he had ordered a mushroom pizza. And on the outside of the box, it said, for home delivery. Home, do you see? So he knows that he will find it there.
Find what?
Grass.
Grass?
Sure. As soon as he finds the grass, the cow will come back. Then he can take the cow and give it to his girlfriend. You see, one of the maids of milking was missing her cow. He can just imagine the chivalry that will take place when he brings the cow into her apartment.
Okay, excuse me for asking a very silly question here, but why would he want to put a cow in the girl's apartment?
I told you. One of the maids of milking was missing her cow. I can tell you that one maid of milking who wasn't a milking is not a happy camper. If she's not happy, the girlfriend's not happy.
All right, speaking of cows, maybe if we knew more about cows, it might help your man on the elevator find his cow and get it to the girlfriend.
Oh, that's a good idea.
Kurt, a word between the two of us here, okay? There is no cow, and there are no maids milking.
I know that, but Bob doesn't. Let's see what happens.
Okay, it could be fun.
Okay, Bob, let's see if this information about cows helps you find old Bessie. Did you know that the first cows arrived in America in 1611? They came with the settlers at Jamestown.
Did you know it takes about 350 squirts to make a gallon of milk?
Did you know that you tell how old a cow is by counting the rings on its horns?
What if the cow ran into the tree and got some of the rings from the tree caught on its horns?
Why would the cow run into a tree?
Well, after it left the picture, it was looking for more grass and mistook the tree for the barn door.
Okay, good guess, but cows have pretty good eyesight. Did you know that while most animals see only in black and white, cows can see in color, except for red?
And did you know their eyes protrude slightly, giving them panoramic vision? They can see almost 360 degrees around.
Yeah, but what if there was water all over the ground?
Good point. Cows navigate by looking at the ground. If the ground is totally covered with water, they don't know where they are.
Did you know that the average lifespan of a cow is 25 years?
Did you know that cows don't pull grass out with their teeth? They wrap their tongue around it and pull.
I do know some things about cows. Did you know that a cow can clean its nose with its tongue? He uses the grass he's pulled up as a tissue. Also, a cow produces about 20,000 pounds of manure every year.
Thank you for bringing that to our attention.
The maids will have to go a-milking in a hurry.
Unless it were winter. Did you know the methane produced by 10 cows could heat a house for a year? But that methane is also a major cause of the destruction of the ozone layer.
If you got enough cows to heat the house, you need two more maids a-milking. I think the guy already has his gift list made out.
But at least they have plenty of milk. Did you know that an average cow produces 200,000 glasses of milk during its lifetime, but it has to drink 30 gallons of water a day to do it?
There's all the information we have on cows.
Let me tell you what I know about cows. I know about cows.
And what is that?
They give 35% more milk while listening to Elvis Presley music. And that's the answer. The mushroom took all the people in the bar out to a bluegrass festival that was being held at the Raleigh Outdoor Amphitheater. Well, you know there's not much lawn area to sit on there. So the mushroom brought in more grass for the people. Several of them were Elvis impersonators, and when the cows heard the music, they left the apartment and went to the festival. Meanwhile, the bartender had brought along the picture frame from the bar, so all the cows went home, except for the one that was missing. And he had been taken by some kid named Jack, who sold him for beans. Back at the apartment, the maids in milking had lots of buckets of milk, so the man, who had given up drinking coffee, would stop by every night for a glass of milk. And that's why he gets off on the 12th floor.
Did you know that this is the end of the show?
Am I right?
Sorry.
But I'm close. Come on, tell me I'm close. Say something.
How about good night?
If you don't tell me the right answer, I'm going to find the mushroom and take him a piece of asphalt back to the bar and tell the bartender that I want beers for me and the fun guy and one more for the road. Then I'm going to go out in the garden and eat worms.
This sounds like a good place for some more phobias.
I'm not afraid of more phobias. How about electrolophobia?
Then you have a fear of chickens?
Or lacanophobia?
That's a fear of vegetables.
Or how about cytophobia?
Then you have a fear of eating.
And scolecephobia?
Then that means you have a fear of worms.
Well, I don't have cytophobia or scolecephobia, so I'm going out in the garden.
I think we better tell him.
I think you're right. Sorry, Bob, that man is only 4 feet tall. He can push the down button when he leaves his apartment, but he can't reach any higher than the button for the 12th floor when he comes home, so he has to walk the rest of the way.
Does that mean he won't be bringing a cow home?
I think his girlfriend will be pleased.
Well, what will she do with all the milk?
This is Kirk Benrood for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Thank you for listening in to another edition of Did You Know?
This is Para Tolleson. This program has been designed for a print and visually impaired audience. Just call and tell us how you like our program at 919-832-5138.
And this is Bob Martin.
We would especially like to thank WRAL.com, a part of the Raleigh-based Capital Broadcasting Company New Media Group, for their continuing financial support that helps keep TRRS on the air. Thank you.
The initial broadcasts of this program are Thursdays at 9 p.m., Saturdays at noon, and Sunday evenings at 8. Podcasts are available following the initial broadcasts. The Triangle Radio Reading Service prides itself in providing services to print and visually impaired audiences. If you know someone who is print or visually impaired, the Triangle Reading Service can provide them with a subchannel receiver so they may hear the many quality programs that the Reading Service provides.
And if you would be willing to help support our service and the special program we provide, please call 919-832-5138.
And did you know, I almost had the problem solved this time. Missed it by that much.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.